This episode of Pub Talk Live was broadcast on December 14th, 2019, with guest co-host Diana Foe and special guest Eric Smith. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the December 14th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. Because the way the months worked out, we haven't had a show for 3 weeks. So welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining us. And I'm your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, the current managing director of Pitch Wars, and a library event planner. And just a reminder, you can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so that you don't miss a show. And you can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below as well. So I'm going to bring on my guest co-host today. I'm super excited for my guest today. We all got the chance to hang out a couple months ago at a writing conference, and I asked them to do this, and I was very happy that they both agreed to do it. So my guest co-host today is Diana Foe. Diana M. Foe is a two-time Hugo Award-nominated editor at Tor Books and Tor.com Publishing, and has worked in the publishing industry under various hats for over a decade. She's also an academic scholar, activist, performer, and general rabble-rouser elsewhere. Books she has edited have gone on to win the Thrill Award, the Dittmar Award, and to become finalists for the Nebula Award, Lambda Literary World, Shirley Jackson Award, and Andre Norton Award for Young Adult. In the steampunk community, she is best known for running Beyond Victoriana, an award-winning US-based blog on multicultural steampunk. You can find her social media info down below. And I'm gonna welcome to the show, Diana. Hello.
Great. Hi. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me to co-host.
Oh, yeah. I was like super excited when you agreed to do it. So let's see who's saying hi. Yeah. Heather says hi. Heather's regular around these parts, as is Ebony. Hey, Ebony. And Kendra. Oh, Caitlin is here. Caitlin Johnson. She was also at that conference we were at. Ebony said, loving the holiday backdrop. Thank you. My mom actually had this just like in storage and was like, do you want this for your December shows? So why not? And Tamara's here. Tamara's been here almost every episode, I think. So Ebony says, hi, Diana.
Hi.
And then Caitlin also says, yay, Diana. All right. So we're going to go ahead and get started. The viewer poll is still available for the next 28 to 30 minutes. So make sure you go and vote in that. So you're going to go to my Twitter account to vote. And it is twitter.com/Sarah_Nicholas. And the question for today is, what book format do you read most often? So make sure you go and vote in that before that poll closes, and we will talk about it at the end of the show. So how are you doing, Diana? Is it cold up there?
Yeah. Well, it was cold briefly, and then now suddenly it's 60s and rainy, and I have no idea what's happening. And part of me is like, oh no, it's climate change striking again. But then again, New York weather, sometimes you just get that weird warm spot in the middle of December, and then everyone is just happy because it's not like a nor'easter. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yes, it was like in the high 70s today, so that's why I need the fake snow behind me. All right, so you have some news for us, Diana. Some kind of sad news.
Unfortunately, the Barnes & Noble sci-fi and fantasy blog had announced recently that they would be deactivating their feed on December 16th, and it's part of a overall consolidation, so readers can still go to, like, the @BNN Buzz account for any news about sci-fi fantasy, which is great, but the fact that they shut down their sci-fi fantasy specific accounts and their blog is really, really disappointing to many people in fandom right now, especially since the bloggers that had worked there are really well known in the community. They had run their own blog review blogs before they were picked up by Barnes & Noble, a couple of them. And a couple of them we just knew through the years because they're at BNN. Has come as a bit of a shock to hear that they suddenly closed down the social media arms. Yeah, so I don't know if any of you guys like follow, you know, science fiction fantasy book community very closely, but what was really interesting for me hearing the news is, one, it was a very sudden shutdown, and I kind of think that it's tied into, you know, related Barnes & Noble news with Waterstones, the owner of Waterstones, now taking over Barnes & Noble, and they're shifting their focus and having a new plan to kind of reboot the entirety of BNN. And one of them is to really bring back a focus on booksellers. So there had been rumors that, you know, instead of having freelance bloggers blog on the site, we should bring in more booksellers. So that's a pro. But on the other hand, it's really sad to have these longstanding reviewers and bloggers suddenly lose their jobs. So it'll be really fascinating to see the evolution about how Barnes & Noble handles those social media aspects from here on out. And a lot of people are just throwing in the support for the freelancers who had left because they have their own sites, they have their own Patreons. People definitely been boosting their work since that announcement was made.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about this in the last episode when they first announced that they were laying everyone off for the young adult blog as well. Mm-hmm. And there was talk about the booksellers being the, you know, kind of filling in for some of that content. But we'll see what happens, I guess. Yeah. It is sad to lose that on such like so focused, you know, on science fiction and fantasy. Mm-hmm. Whereas the BNN Buzz is like covers everything, you know. All right, so Cengage Elsevier, I don't know how to say that word actually. Macmillan Learning, McGraw-Hill, and Pearson, jointly calling themselves the Educational Publishers Enforcement Group, filed suit last week to stop pirate ebook sites from selling counterfeit ebooks. These sites will like place Google ads to show up when people search for the books and link, you know, to the pirate site. But in the meantime, the court granted a temporary restraining order to shut down the activity, which a lot of people saw as a good sign. The publishers have filed similar suits in the past and one against textbook counterfeiters to the tune of $34 million in April 2018. And when I read this article and I found out about this, I just thought it's so strange to me that they have to file this suit to stop book pirates from doing something that's already illegal, you know?
So, yeah, I also kind of thought that it was fun to hear, at least from like, oh, the hunting pirate aspect, that on the nonfiction textbook side, there's some success. Because oftentimes, when it comes to the fiction side, you know, the pirates just escape into the ether. They just jump aboard their airships. I'm using too many analogies here. I'll stop right now. It's great to see that in that aspect, you have a good chunk of publishing being able to actually fight back against, you know, pirating in a very substantial way.
Yeah. Heather said, I'm glad they're going to start cracking down on ebook piracy. So Tamara said, we're having a heat wave here in Oz. I don't know if we're having heat wave here or we're just like not getting cold weather. It's just like staying. And then Ebony said it's freezing in the Midwest. So they have a wide range.
But yeah, talking about some more industry news, turning towards the metadata aspect. We all know that books have ISBNs, also known as International Standard Book Numbers. It's a system that started in 1967. At first, there was 10-digit number, and then in 2007, it was updated to 13 digits, usually starting with the 978 suffix. And now, the latest news on that end is that starting in early 2020, the 10-digit number will be replaced entirely by the 13-digit number. Some people are concerned because some systems automatically convert this 13-digit number by removing the 978 prefix. But in addition to making that switch from 10 to 13, Bowker, who is the company that institutes and oversees ISBNs, they're also adding a 979 prefix. And people are worried because some systems that publishers use, they automatically, insert, a 13-digit ISBN every time a 10-digit one is created. And now if you have a 978 and a 978 979 prefix, it's just going to be confusing because they don't know whether the conversion will go through in the proper way. So, that's, some concerns people have now, but we already know that internationally in other countries, they already have the 979 prefix in place. Just it hasn't been done in the US yet. So it'd be in, so we're going to see in 2020 whether that causes confusion, whether, for publishers and for metadata, that is something that we all have to start reviewing and how our systems process it.
Yeah, when I read this article, of course, my first thought always goes to what is the worst case scenario? Like, what is the worst thing that could happen? And I was thinking, what if some, a school is trying to order an, like a picture book or something, and it has a 979 prefix that matches like a 978 prefix of like an erotica or something? That would be like the worst case. They just get that.
Yes, and then it's like that's when like BISAC codes like will also come into play too. Like, oh my gosh, is this right? And I this is totally like my random association. But whenever I think of the 978 conversion, I also think because I'm originally from Massachusetts, 978 is an area code. But thankfully I've never encountered like my someone's Massachusetts phone number and mistaken that for an ISBN code.
Yeah, Eric just commented in our private chat because he's like waiting in the wings that it's like publishing Y2K, and I had the exact same thought as well. Funny side story, I was in Guam for Y2K, and it's like where America's Day begins, so it's like it was gonna be the first place in the United States where it switched over. And my dad's in the military, and so they were like really, really watchful, and like all the guys had to be on base and at the boat and everything whenever the clock switched over. And so like all the families were also on the docks, and so we just had this like massive like dry party on the docks because everyone had to be there. All right, so the Writer Beware blog, which if you are a querying or an author on submission, you're going to make sure you check out the Writer Beware blog often. But they have an update on Month 9 Books, a smaller young adult publisher. In 2016, they reverted rights to as many as 50 authors and reduced their acquisitions. When that happened, a lot of authors contacted Victoria Strauss, who runs the Writer Beware blog, with complaints about late or missing payments for both staff and authors, royalty accounting issues, delayed publication dates, broken marketing promises, communication issues, as well as harsh treatment from CEO and founder Georgia McBride. These issues have been ongoing, and all the authors were afraid of retaliation. And Victoria said, this is like a really interesting sentence in this article. I've rarely encountered a situation where authors seemed so fearful of their publisher. And like this coming from Victoria Strauss, who's like, this is what she does, you know, she like uncovers, you know, publishers acting badly. But now she is again getting contacted by multiple writers who say they are suffering the same issues that they saw in 2016. So by the way, all of the news articles that we're going to be talking about today, we're going to have a link in the description later tonight. And if you're watching this repeat, it will probably already be up. And so you can like find out more information about all the things that we're talking about. And that article from the Writer Beware blog is going to be in there as well. So make sure you check that out if you're someone who might be considering looking at one of these publishers. Now, Diana, I think you're going to bring us some happy news, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of rough hearing about, you know, 9-month books, especially since I do know authors who had been affected by it back in 2016. But on the upside, though, you know, recent news that Gary Paulsen, who is one of my favorite middle grade authors, I loved him as a kid. He signed a new 3-book deal with Farah Strauss and Gareau for a memoir and 2 new middle grade novels. You know, he's still really active as a writer. You know, and he apparently lives on a mountaintop in New Mexico where cell phones don't reach, and says he's done with sled dogs and sailing to Fiji, and he's just going to, quote, going to write for myself out now. And what really makes me excited is first hearing the story about, you know, I was reading it in Publishers Weekly and how the editor was also just having a casual conversation. Is that like way back in 2018, saying, oh, like, I would really love to work with Gary Paulsen someday, and to have that deal, you know, finally work out for FSG is really, really exciting for them. And I'm excited for them. yeah, it's, you know, it definitely, because I think, you know, it's, you know, the way that the Paulsen books work, and I think it works for many people who have read them, is that, you know, it had this survival angle that didn't seem over the top and was very matter of fact. You know, The Hatchet was one of my favorite books in grade school, specifically because it made me, it instilled like this prepper sense in my 11-year-old brain. And I'm like, oh, if I was caught in a random plane crash and had to like survive out in the middle of the Canadian woods, what would I do? Would I eat turtle eggs? I don't know. It was him and Gene Craighead George, I think, headed that whole survival middle grade lit fic trend back then.
Yeah. Teaching us all how to survive at a young age. Mm-hmm. Caitlin said Hatchet was amazing in those middle grade years. Yeah, isn't it like Gary Paulsen lives on a mountain in New Mexico where cell phones don't reach, like exactly what you want and expect from Gary Paulsen? It's like so on brand.
Yeah, it also feels like all writers theoretically should live in places of no cell service at least sometime in the year, so they have no excuse but to write.
Kendra said it sounds like he's living his best life. Yeah, so that's really exciting. I feel like a lot of people grew up with those books and are excited to see he's still at 80, still writing new books. That's pretty mm-hmm. cool. All right, so James Patterson has awarded 500 indie booksellers a holiday bonus of $500 each. He said, I've said this many times before, but I can't say it enough. Booksellers save lives, mm-hmm. children's booksellers especially. They guide children to books they'll genuinely enjoy and in turn create a new generation of readers. I'm happy to be able to acknowledge them and the important work they do in any way that I can this holiday season. Yeah, so I know he's done this for a couple of years, and I just think it's like a cool thing for him to do. He doesn't have to do this, and like I feel like everyone, I have like kind of mixed feelings on James Patterson, but I just think this is something that's really cool for him to do.
It's also nice, for the Patterson brand, having both the foresight but also the genuine concern about we have to support the readers that we have and the booksellers and the many, many people out there that support the book. And so as much as like, oh, this feels like a little bit of a PR move, it also feels like I could probably only name a handful of authors that have the ability to even do that to help support indie booksellers. And so I'm glad that he's doing it,
Yeah, and we talked about on last episode, a report came out that like 60% of booksellers said they could have used financial assistance in the past few years. And so he's providing it. So it's great.
So, and moving on, NetGalley, who, reviewers everywhere might be very familiar with. It's a site that allows people, including, reviewers, librarians, booksellers, to receive advanced review copies. They are finally allowing audiobooks to be added to their site. For now, they're only including little excerpts, but soon they'll be able to have the capability of hosting full audiobook files that can be requested by this coming summer. Okay, I'm gonna like confess them here. I have a really hard time listening to audiobooks just because for a long time it was very difficult for me to do audio processing for narrative forms. And I literally am trying to develop that skills by listening to podcasts. And I can only do right now I can only do like the very conversational ones or the NPR ones or Serial or something that has a more of a nonfiction bent because the information is processed for me easier. But aside from my fallibles, I'm really excited for everyone else who listens to and enjoys audiobooks. I think it's a huge positive step forward, especially since right now, unless the publisher has a capability of hosting excerpts on their own websites, I typically see a lot of audiobook excerpts just posted on SoundCloud or Spotify or something like that. And it'll be nice to have one main source with all the other book-related things where you can request them.
Some people in the comments are super excited. Anyone who's been watching this show for a while knows I'm excited. I'm a huge audiobook fan. Ebony said that's awesome. Every time I mention an audiobook on here, Ebony's like, I'm gonna add it to my TBR. So I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I think people know, and like I write for Book Riot, and I'm on several like distribution lists for like audiobook review copies, and I think this is just going to make it easier for me because like every single publisher does the process slightly differently, and it can be like I'm getting free audiobooks, I'm not going to complain, but it can be sometimes a little difficult. And there are some publishers where I'm like, if I'm tired that week, I won't even look at their list because the process is so much more difficult. So it's really going to be great for me. I don't know how anyone else feels about it, but. Okay, so just to, Kendra said this is huge for accessibility side of things. I haven't been able to read print for ages and can't read regular ARCs.
Yeah,
That's
that's a really
cool.
great point.
Yeah. Ebony said I surpassed 100 audiobooks this year. Wow. Congrats. I hit 100, but I can't talk about like 20 of them because it was for the audiobook awards. I'm the judge for the audiobook awards. And we're not allowed to say which ones we read or something. So the Register of Copyrights, Karen Temple, resigned from her position for a new job, In 2016, Carla Hayden's removal of former register led to efforts to remove the position out from under the Library of Congress. And so that's why this is kind of newsworthy, as many people are wondering if this will kind of spur a renewal of those efforts and try to move that position out from Library of Congress again. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, to talk about another news item that affects indie booksellers, on December 12th, employees of McNally Jackson voted to join the NYC Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, which will represent approximately 90 employees who handle sales, events, stocking, and information services. In the union's announcement, Catherine Harper, who works at the Williamsburg store, says, quote, "Workers across all five stores face issues of harassment at work, favoritism, and lack of dignity and respect. By coming together, we are stronger, and I am confident we can shape our workplace into a place we all want to come to work every day. It's about time McNally Jackson workers had a real seat at the table of the company and were ready to get to work on our first contract." Yeah, I am really, really happy for them.
Yeah.
You know?
Have you been there? It's in New York City, right?
Yeah. It's a New York City based chain. I think they also have a couple stores in New Jersey. So it might be tri-state area sort of thing. So I'm just really excited, first of all, because one of the underlying conversations that has been coming up in recent years in publishing is how do we support publishing professionals who might be in situations where they don't get, you know, proper benefits, they're not compensated fairly, they have to deal with, you know, issues of harassment at work. And, you know, and there has been talk, you know, in various corners of the industry of like, it would be great if we were to unionize. And again, you know, that can, that is a very complicated process. But more and more you see industries that are typically seen as, you know, retail based or administrative based, which historically didn't have unions, mm-hmm. now we're trying to pick up and be like, yes, we deserve to have those, you know, rights, and we deserve to be able to have some bargaining power at the table as well. So I know out of the big five, HarperCollins is, you know, well known for being a unionized company. And it's been interesting, but how they were able to unionize, they worked with the Teamsters. So it wasn't even with, you know, any sort of writing based or administrative based union that helped them allow to become unionized. So it was, you know, and so people are trying to figure out ways one way or another, how can we be able to look into this for ourselves, especially if we don't have any historical organizations that have supported us in the same way.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's great. I think it looks like it's going to be a good thing for them. So hopefully, yeah. All right. So we just have a couple more things to talk about before we bring on our special guest for the evening. As most people probably know, the Goodreads Choice Awards were announced this week. You can see all the winners in the link that will be added to the description later tonight, but here are a couple of highlights. Margaret Atwood's The Testaments took home the prize for Best Fiction Book, and I thought that was super interesting because she got more than double the votes of the second place book. So that was a clear majority there. Red, White, and Royal Blue by Casey McQuiston. Oh, goodness. I messed up that name. Won both the romance and the debut category. It's also, spoiler, going to be our audiobook of the week. That was just a coincidence. And Ali Wong winning in the humor category was the only author of color in the winner's list. So I think we can celebrate for the winners and also wish that the winners had been more inclusive, right?
So, yeah, I definitely agree on that point. And yeah, it's, you know, it's also exciting for me. Like, I mean, I pay attention to all the Goodreads winners, but I have a special, you know, investment for like the science fiction, fantasy, and horror ones. In terms of, the fantasy and science fiction, I was really interested in the fact that even if they weren't, winners, there were definitely several titles in the shortlist that had, different types of representation. For fantasy, there were several books that had queer content in it, which, queer main characters, which I thought was really exciting. For horror, I was, invested in, a couple of different books. Imaginary Friend by Stephen Chomsky, infamously known for The Perks of Being a Wallflower. That was his first book, like, after that. So it's been several years. And so to know that, several years after writing this book, his next book is a horror one, is very eye-opening, and to me speaks about the rising interest in horror in general and how that's crossing more and more into the mainstream fiction world, which is personally very exciting. And so one more item of the news. There is a new literary agency that aims to expand contemporary African fiction for young people. And in, as well as being a literary agency, they're going to have individual mentoring and working globally in order to find new talent. So it's called Accord Literary. It was launched earlier this year by two longtime children's publishing professionals, Deborah Ankura from Ghana and Sarah Odendina from the UK. And they're specifically looking to represent Africa-based writers for middle grade and YA with a goal of reaching young readers around the world. I personally have an investment with representation in publishing, and not only in terms of underserved and marginalized communities in the US, but I just really enjoy the international aspect of this agency. I know that there are several publishing houses that have recently announced established relationships. I think Bloomsbury recently talked about working in tandem with a Chinese publishing house to bring more YA, fiction to the board. I also know from my personal experience, we've also brought in, Chinese science fiction translation, for ourselves at Tor. And I do think that, writers from Africa are particularly very eager to break out more in a global stage. It's a very complicated question in terms of representation, because there's also a lot of really active, writers from the African and Caribbean diaspora. And, I don't want to speak for either community, but as an outside observer, I do know that it, has become very serious, where people take stances where, like, where they think that the diaspora is being supported more by the English language speaking world, even though there's so much talent, from the African continent. And so having this literary agency, I think, speaks to people listening to that dialogue and trying to do something about it.
Yeah. All right. So Eric, we're going to bring Eric on in just a minute. I'm going to introduce him. Eric Smith is a literary agent and author from Elizabeth, New Jersey. As an agent at PS Literary, he's worked on award-winning and New York Times best-selling books. A young adult author, his latest book, The Girl in the Grove, was published by Flux. His next novel, Don't Read the Comments, is due out with Inkyard Press in January 2020. He lives in Philadelphia with his wife, son, and the even more famous Corgi. So, welcome, Eric. Hi.
Hey, everyone. Hi. I'm coming to you live from my kitchen.
Excellent.
And I am excited to chat.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw earlier, I'm wearing the spaceship pin that you gave me.
Oh,
yeah. It's, what does it say? Log on, fight back.
Yes.
All right. So, Eric, I'm so glad that you came on the show and you and Diana came together, because I've really enjoyed just visiting with both of you at FWA, and so I'm happy that we can have a little mini virtual reunion here.
That conference was kind of fun.
Yeah. Caitlin said, Eric, a lovely kitchen. Benny says, hi.
Hello.
Catherine Locke says, hi, Eric. All caps.
Hello. All right. Lots of familiar faces. This is nice.
Yeah. we got a couple more. Heather says, hi. Heather's been watching the show for a long time.
Hi.
Yeah. All right. So you have an anthology, Battle of the Bands, which you put together with Lauren Gabaldi, who mm-hmm. I know in real life, coming out in 2021. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came together?
Yeah, so Lauren and I were at a conference in, Nashville, for one of the SCBDVI conferences. And we were sitting in the airport. It was like 4 a.m. and we were just talking about various ideas we had. And she said she always wanted to do a YA anthology about a battle of the bands. I was like, that's an amazing idea. Oh my God, I love that. And we were talking about it, and she asked me if I would do it with her, and if I would be a co-editor, since I'd done an anthology before. Of course, I said yes immediately. And we got to emailing all of our friends, and it was just a ton of fun. And the whole premise behind the book is that it takes place at a high school's Battle of the Bands night in the course of just a couple of hours. And all the stories from all the authors mesh into one another. So there's like the teenagers who are running the lights, and like the teenagers who are handling the sound, and the, you know, the kids in the bands. And it's just a ton of fun. And it gave me the excuse to email my favorite singer, Justin Courtney Pierre, Motion City Soundtrack, who has written the story for the collection. So I'm excited. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah. Kendra, I just want to say, she said, so here for Agent Augie's dad. It's your claim to fame, right?
Yeah, maybe I can get him on camera later.
Catherine has a follow-up question about the anthology. How do you even organize that? I saw Lauren tweeting about Excel sheets.
Yes, she has a very detailed Excel sheet. And we had a Google Doc that we shared with everybody, where we listed all the individual bands, we listed all the different characters. And then once all the stories came in, Lauren and I edited them together to sort of mesh all the stories into one another. And then we ran them by the contributors to make sure they approved of our different changes and the stuff that we wanted to add. So it was a lot of back and forth. But some of the contributors, since they were friends already, surprised us with stories that were already very well mushed together. Jeff Zettner and Brittany Cavallaro stories, like, they could be a book. Yeah, it was really great.
We have a couple of complaints in the comments.
Ooh.
People are upset that you're not wearing the Corgi blazer.
Oh, no. Wow, all right. Sorry, friend.
You have an image, Eric. You have to maintain it. But speaking a little bit about the various hats you wear, you're an agent and an author, and you write for several book news and review sites, and you also do a podcast, and you also teach. So that's a lot of things to juggle. So much like publishing related work, how do you balance it all, and how do you find time for it?
It's hard. I actually really struggled with work-life balance this year. I signed up for a co-working space full-time to really separate being at home with handling work. And it's tricky. You know, I try to give myself one day a week where I'm doing stuff for me. You know, I'm working on my writing, or I'm working on a blog post, or fussing with the podcast. And then the other days I'm busy with my job, busy working for my clients and stuff. That's really what does it. having that like one separate day and keeping things, at the workspace. Otherwise, I'd be up till midnight every night, which I was. It wasn't great.
Yeah. So speaking of that, I was just at a literary event this weekend or this past weekend and discovered some folks I know who are like really pretty firmly entrenched in the writing community. They didn't really understand how newer agents make money and the sometimes like kind of harsh realities there when you're starting out. And still some people are like critical of agents with side gigs. So as much as you're comfortable, can you like speak to that issue?
Yeah, I mean, people shouldn't be uncomfortable with agents that have side gigs because it doesn't pay right away and it doesn't pay enough to be sustainable for a while, you know? I still mentor an MFA program that helps a lot with the bills. But yeah, they shouldn't, you know, dismiss someone just because they have a another hustle on the side, because yeah. That's what lets us do what we love.
Yeah. So I did hear, feel free to verify this random fact. I've heard anecdotally from agents, but I heard from new agents, it takes about 5 years until they actually start, you know, getting enough commissions to live on their own. And until then, it's just whatever side hustles that they can get.
Yeah, that sounds about right. You know, sometimes it's a little less. You know, it depends on if you've sold a blockbuster book or something, you know, and then sometimes it's easier. But it's definitely not something that like happens after like year one or two.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of submissions and stuff like that, it is now December 14th, 2 weeks after the end of NaNoWriMo. Have you received any NaNoWriMo novels in your slush pile yet?
I don't think I have. You know, our agency closed to submissions just yesterday. You know,
yeah.
And yeah, I don't think I got any nano novels in. Maybe that's because of Print Run. I don't know. Like, I love that podcast to death. And they did a whole episode on like, don't send your nano novel out yet. But yeah, no, haven't gotten any yet.
All right. That's funny. Cause when I saw that y'all closed to queries yesterday, I was like, is it to avoid nano novels? I know. It's like holidays, busy time and catch up and everything. But, So fun question. What is your favorite thing about being a literary agent?
Probably seeing the books in the stores, you know? Like there is always like, you know, making those phone calls and doing all that is always really lovely, but like seeing it in the bookstore and taking photos of the books, like they're my children and like posting them on social media, I love that. It makes me so happy.
Yeah.
Nice.
I do that too. And I think, oh, it's an excuse for like having new content because I don't really know how to maintain content online. Oh, look at this pretty picture. It's my author. It's great.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I was in the Strand just a couple of days ago and like just went everywhere, ran around trying to find all the different agency books. I love doing that.
Yeah, I love going to the bookstore. Like, I know that author. I know mm-hmm. that author. It's like I visit my friends. Heather, yeah. Back to the nano thing, said hopefully people are revising their nano novel first. Yes, in case you're watching and you're unclear, you should definitely do that.
Oh, yes.
But she also said I know some did pitch them through the December hit mad.
So
make sure you revise first.
Yeah. And I'm not like talking smack about nano novels because like The Night Circus is one of my favorite novels of all time.
Yeah.
So that was Aaron Morgenstern's nano novel. So like, yeah.
Yeah.
So not as fun question, but you already talked about your favorite things. What are your least favorite thing about being a literary agent?
Oh boy. Maybe contracts, you know? I'm not a very confrontational person, but you have to be, you know, like you have to be when it's contract time. You have to have those conversations. So my anxiety peaks a lot and I get really anxious. It makes me sweat a little bit. And then maybe when something doesn't sell, you know, that's always really, really hard. You know, social media and the internet, we always hear about all the all the great things that happen and all the celebrations. You never hear about the books that don't quite make it. You know, we mourn those in private when we cry in the shower. You know, I think about those books a lot.
All right. Okay, so you talk a lot about diversity and inclusivity in publishing. What do you think are the most important actions people at all levels, whether it's like readers or writers or agents or editors or journalists or whoever, can do to help make the publishing industry more inclusive?
Ooh, wow. Like there's so many different things you could be doing, you know, like at the publishing level, you know, it's hiring those people, you know, like we can, you know, agents can find the diverse writers, but, you know, we also need more diverse editors and marketing people and publicists and just like everybody at every level. And then finding ways to support those people in-house. You know, it always breaks my heart when you find out that someone, you know, a person of color, someone else in the community, like leaves publishing because they're not feeling supported by the community that's already there. So, you know, making that happen, bringing people on, giving them the support they need. From the reader's place, you know, talk about those books, you know, shout about them, give them to everybody. You know, I certainly have my favorites that, like, I almost never have them on my bookshelf anymore because I'm too busy giving them away to people and making sure people know about them. You know, leave reviews, do whatever you can to make sure people are hearing about them. Yeah, so hire people and then support the books.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked on the second episode. Amanda Nelson was our guest.
Yeah.
And I know she is really big into like examining your own reading. Like, look at the last 20 books you read, and if it's all like white authors, you need to make an adjustment, you know? And like when I first started writing for Book Riot, she actually had a big effect on like the way I thought about like what books I was picking, you know?
Yeah. And I definitely am in total agreement with you, Eric, about what does it look like to have, you know, representation move on to the professional side and what can we do about it? Yeah. I always think about a couple of organizations that are actively having that conversation. One is POC in publishing, which, you know, they're a great nonprofit. They're doing a lot of work to support both, you know, POC authors, as well as publishing professionals, as well as those who are interested in getting their foot in the door. I also think about the Representation Matters Mentorship Program, which is going on into its third or fourth year, I think, at this point. And they are a mentorship program that specifically is about getting POC, and they run on a quarterly basis. They have a really interesting alumni network since they've been running for a while. Admittedly, full disclosure, I am one of the mentors as part of the program, but we're definitely looking for more talent to help participate. So if anyone is interested, go like Google, like either one of these groups, they're great. But moving on, for the aspiring authors listening in, can you tell us a bit about what catches your attention in the slush pile? What are the qualities that make you request to see more material?
Oh, that's always so hard, you know, because for me, it's just, I just have to want to read the story, you know, like I have to read the query and, you know, it reads like jacket copy and I just need to pick it up. My tip is to always just have a really great hook attached. There's this agent I like a lot, Gordon Warnock, who at a conference one time said it was the hook, the book, the cook that gets him when it comes to a query letter. I've heard tons of people say that. And it's just that little hook is what's going to make me request it, you know, the fastest. And that's usually something that's like, you know, my novel is, I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. You know, my novel is, never mind, it's too far up. My novel is Shadow Shaper meets The Greysheer, and it's perfect for fans of, you know, well, I guess those authors, with finish that word count, whatever the word count is, and then you mentioned the genre. It's just like a little sentence that gives us that quick, you know, I want to pick this up and read it line. Something like that is usually what's going to get me. I wish there was like a perfect like equation for the query letter, but it just has to make me want to read it.
Right. And it's so subjective too, because when you say like hook, and I say it all the time too, like it all depends on the hook. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of overlaps with being like, what does hook mean? Is it something that sounds super commercial? Is it something that sounds super personal to the reader's taste, mm-hmm. to the editor or agent's taste, or to like, this is definitely something that this publishing house has done before really well. Therefore, it could make a great hook if I, you know, have the right comp titles, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes it's also about, you know, if it isn't my particular taste, I know who the reader is for that book, you know, like not every book has to be something that I relate to. That's impossible. You know, I just have to know who the reader might be and who the person is that needs it. Like I think about the books that I've worked on, and like I had a book come out earlier this year called Eat to Feed, which is a cookbook for breastfeeding mothers that helps with like lactation production. That's not a book for me, you know, but it's certainly a book for people who I know would need it, you know, my wife's kind of idea. It's not just an agent's job to find books that they like. You're probably a bad agent if that's what you're doing. You have to think about the readers out there who might be able to, you know, grab onto whatever the title is.
Yeah. Great.
I just want to draw attention there. Some of the viewers are having some fun conversation in the comments. Tamaretta asked, if you could reread a book for the first time, what would it be and why? And several people have answered that question, so feel free to join that conversation in the comments as well. Some good books being mentioned.
Nice.
All right, so Eric, you recently published a blog post that was kind of like what you learned this year in publishing, right? And there was a part of it that like just really, really resonated with me. And like, because this is like something that, I've been struggling with, and I know a lot of people have been struggling with, and you're talking about like when you get up, like send the elevator down, right? And you said, but one thing no one really preps you for is when you've sent the elevator down and you watch people soar right by you on the way up, never to talk to you again. They've got what they wanted from you, and that's the end of that. It happens. It's happened to me plenty, and I've seen it happen to a few author friends, as it's a frequent topic of conversation on book social media, and it hurts a lot. And so I don't even know if I really have a question. Like, I just wanted to kind of share that. And like, I really like your attitude towards it, because you're like, just keep doing it anyway, you know, because there are still people who need your help. And I just really appreciated that.
Oh, thank you. It's hard. You know, and I feel like it's a thing that happens no matter what your profession is. You know, there's people that like get what they want and then off they go. You know, you need to brush it off and keep being the better person.
Yeah. And, you know, I definitely can also relate to that too as an editor. And it's, you know, I totally understand where like writers get jealous of other writers, but I don't think writers realize that editors can get jealous of other editors too. You know, especially it's like, oh, I wish like I bought that book, or like I really wanted it, but I couldn't get it. Or just like, oh my gosh, I wish I could have worked with that author. Yeah, we get that all the time as well. So it's not just writers, you know, wondering about their careers and if they're going fast enough or big enough as they wanted to. Like, I think a lot of people in the industry have those thoughts.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So, but like speaking on a more, you know, positive note, Don't Read the Comments comes out in January. So can you tell us a little bit about that book and what readers can expect from it?
Yeah. So it's about two teenagers who meet in a, massively multiplayer online role-playing game that's sort of like World of Warcraft mashed together with like EVE Online, smashed with No Man's Sky. You know, it's not a game that exists, because the stuff that happens in it is kind of impossible. And they're both very different. One wants to write for video games, write stories. The other is a somewhat famous YouTube-esque, glitch-esque streamer. And when they meet in the game, they form this cute little relationship. They're starting to become friends or getting a lot closer. And then the girl gets doxxed. She gets she gets harassed off the internet. And it's about them trying to figure out, you know, navigate this complicated situation about are they going to go after the bullies? Are they going to stay quiet? The boy wants to help, but also doesn't. Also kind of is learning lessons about maybe that he shouldn't, you know, not all girls are princesses that need to be saved. And it's a book about relationships and unfortunately cyber harassment, which happens all too often to people of color who are just trying to have a good time in digital spaces.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, that's a super, you know, relatable, pertinent, timely book, I think. And it's an evergreen conversation. You know, I think that young people have to navigate a lot more complicated social scenes because of, you know, social media and the internet. And then, like, mm-hmm. I can't imagine if I were, you know, 14, 15, 16, how I would even start to think about that. You know, mm-hmm. all things that, you know, teenagers deal with online today. So.
Yeah.
But
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. I'm really excited about reading it too. I mean, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, this is such a dire book. Like, this is terrible. but yeah, I'm also really looking forward to it too, because it sounds like, you know, as much as we sometimes feel trepidation about the internet, it really emphasizes the meaning of friendship and the empowerment you can get, you know, from other people online as well. Oh.
Yeah.
So we're getting a little echo again. It fixed itself earlier, so hopefully it fixes itself again. All right, so last question. It's a question that I ask every guest. And that is, first I actually wanted to say, Caitlin said, oh yes, agents get so jealous of each other. She's looking at you, Eric.
It's true that we do, you know. I definitely have some agents who I get pretty jealous of pretty frequently because they're working with like my favorite writers, you know, and
yeah.
How dare you?
So it's funny. So Eric is the agent for my agent, oh, yeah. Rebecca Potos.
Is that like conception or something?
Yeah. Agents have agents. I have an agent who handles my writing. You know, it's, you need that distance from your work. That's for sure. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine, like, trying to pitch Diana a book and then, like, having, like, a PS where I'm like, hey, by the way, I've written a novel. Would you like to?
Yeah.
Like, FYI.
Yeah. All right. So back to the question. What is the most important book you've ever read?
Ooh, wow. That is really hard. Because there's the books that made me want to work in publishing, and there's the books that made me a reader. I'll go with the one that made me want to be more involved in publishing, and that's Hero by Perry Moore. It's this YA novel that came out in like 2007, I think. And that was right around the time I started working in publishing, and I just remember reading it and like feeling like, oh my god, I want to make books like this. You know, it's this really wonderful YA novel about a teen who lives in like sort of like a DC universe type of world where there's like a Batman, there's like a Superman. That's not what they're called because the guy would probably have gotten sued if he named all these characters like that. And his father is a Batman type who's just like very smart, but not an actual superhero, you know, no magic or anything like that. And now he's old and he's retired and he's working as a janitor and he's very bitter about superheroes because all of his friends are still super and flying around. So he hates superheroes. And he is always telling his son how much he hates superheroes. And then his son turns out to be a superhero and has powers. And also his son is gay and he's trying to figure out how to tell his dad. So there's like this, he has to like come out twice to mm-hmm. do his father. And it's just this wonderful book about like identity. And I just, I feel like I'm forever chasing the high of that novel in the books that I look for as an agent. Cause it was just wonderful.
Awesome. One of these days, I'm just going to like sit down and read all of the books that have been the answer to this question.
That's a good idea.
Good. All right, Eric, that is all we have for you. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, it's great to have you on. This was super fun.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to like have this mini reunion.
All right, so we're going to say goodbye to Eric, and then I have a couple things to close out the show. All right, that was fun, huh?
Yeah.
Eric's always fun to chat with. So it is time for our audiobook of the week, which is, if you haven't seen the show before, is a feature that I added because I love audiobooks. And so the audiobook of the week, which I chose, by the way, before the Goodreads Choice Awards were announced, was Red, White, and Royal Blue by Casey McQuiston. So I guess I just called that the Goodreads winning. And it asks the question, what happens when America's first son falls in love with the Prince of Wales? That's kind of the tagline that the publisher provided. And it's just like this super fun love story between like the son of the president who's running for re-election and the Prince of Wales, who they were always kind of like a little bit of enemies before. And they have to spend some time together due to a scandal, and they start, you know, spoiler alert, it's a romance, falling for each other. And I just really enjoyed this. And it's like, yeah, it's got this like alternate political scenario that just felt so comforting to me. Like, I just really enjoyed kind of blanketing myself in that for a little bit. And I never do this. I listen to audiobooks when I drive or when I walk my dog or sometimes when I like am doing house chores. And I just got home one day and I was like, I don't want to stop. And I just laid on the bed and kept listening to it until it was done. And so I just really liked it. And I finished it faster than I finished most audiobooks because of that. So,
I read the book. I have a couple of questions. Is the audiobook of dual narrators or is it just one person?
I'm trying to remember. It's been a couple of months since I listened to it. Let's see. I think someone who's watching right now watched it or listened to it. They commented before. And so we'll see if they answer it because I honestly can't remember right now.
Great. Because I always enjoy that aspect. I'm still learning how to listen to audiobooks, but that's why I picked up from podcasts. If there's more than one host, then it's easier to follow the conversation for me. And so just having like two different, especially since, you know, just having two different narrators on this book would have been an interesting choice because they're such drastically different personalities as well as different nationalities. Yeah. So they're accents, but there also could be like quirks and yeah. So
Kendra answered, she said it's one person.
Good.
Yeah, I do remember the narration being really good. I also, when I first started listening to audiobooks or trying to, I also had trouble, like I basically got bored, like I got distracted and I would like, my attention would veer off, you know? And then I started speeding them up and that like fixed everything. And so now I listen to them at 1.8 and I feel like, for me, it's more like a reading experience because like the words are just coming at me and I'm not kind of getting lost in like the performance, you know?
Okay.
And some people, like I know a lot of people who speed their audiobooks up like that too. But like for some people, they can't stand it. And so I feel like just experiment and like play around and see what works for you.
Okay. Yeah. I've never actually tried reading or listening to an audiobook at a faster speed. I didn't hear about that as a concept until several months ago when people were talking about different speed rates. I'm like, what are you talking about? Aren't they all going at the same level? Like, you know, it was revolutionary, but I haven't actually tried that myself yet. So it's a good tip.
Yeah, I had a friend get in the car with me one time when I was listening to an audiobook, and it was like content that he would have been interested in. It was like a nonfiction book at that time. And he was, I will say, like, English was like his third language. He spoke it fluently, of course. But he was like, "What is this? I cannot listen to this." It was like, "Can you slow it down?" And so I had to slow it down to like regular speed. And I just felt like I was like pulling every word out of the narrator. And so now I'm like spoiled. I can't listen to them at regular speed up anymore. Kendra said, "Yes, speeding up is key for me too." Yeah, I know it works for a lot of people.
Okay.
So, yeah. I also have very strong opinions on like narrators. Like, I have my favorite narrators. All right. So we're going to talk about the viewer poll. So Diana, you said you hadn't looked at the results, so this is going to be a surprise for you, right? Yeah. So let me go ahead and pop those up. And let's see what it says. All right, so 36% paperback, 22% hardcover. So that is 58% print, basically. 31% ebook and 11% audiobook. And yeah, so this is, as a reminder, like, what do they listen to most often? So it doesn't mean they're not listening or watching or reading, whatever. I forgot. I'm so stuck on audiobooks. I'm like, they're not listening in other formats. It doesn't mean they're not reading in other formats. But those are the ones that they're consuming books most often. Yeah. And so I really like it, because like, I get this question all the time when I speak about publishing, is print dead? And this is 58% of the people are reading print. So obviously not.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually surprised that paperback came out on top versus audiobook, because the stat that I hear all the time now is how audiobook is a fast growing market in the industry, especially for my genre. So it's good to have that in perspective. And it's also interesting to see that it's, you know, ebook, while it's still, you know, 31%, it's definitely not the majority. And that's also something I've been hearing. I think in the latest issue of PW, they were saying how the overall ebook sales numbers have been dropping since 2014. So to see this, you know, just like super casual poll, is a very anecdotal kind of proof that, like, okay, so not everyone is going to be total ebook converts.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, like, you have to keep in mind, like, this is kind of skewed by, like, who follows me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I said it was anecdotal, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
and, like, you know, the people who follow me tend to be usually voracious readers. I think a lot of the audiobook growth has been from people who weren't really reading a lot before, especially in the nonfiction market. Ebony said, "What audiobooks was robbed?" Beth said, "Paperback doesn't hurt to hold for longer." Kevin and I were talking about this poll over dinner. I totally read print as well. Oh, I clicked on the wrong thing. There's something comforting about curling up with a good book and hot tea. Beth said, "My books are here for a good time, not a long time." Oh man. Yeah, I most of my reading these days is audiobooks, but that's because, like, with everything else in my life, it's hard to find time. But I have a book always ongoing, and I'll read like 10 to 15 minutes before bed, but that obviously makes for like a slow finish rate. All right. So the quote of the week is another thing that I just kind of added because I like quotes, and there's really no deeper meaning to it behind that. So the quote of the week for this week is, "It is what you read when you don't have to that determines what you will be when you can't help it."
Yeah. Oscar Wilde.
Yeah. I really like this because, like, I read almost everything when I didn't have to, and now I work in a library and I write books. So
So you're just surrounded by text all the time.
Yeah. I don't know if that's what he meant, but.
Yeah. That is a really good quote. For me, when I don't have to read for work, I still read genres. I don't know what it says about myself. Yeah, there we have it.
Yeah. I guess it says you're working in the right genre, right?
Right. Or maybe I am just obsessed and a workaholic and I'm not admitting it at all.
Oh, that's true of all of us. All right. So I think that is everything today. Diana, thank you so much for joining me. I really had a great time tonight. And I feel like the comment section, they had a great time today too.
Yeah. Thank you so much again for having me on board to guest co-host.
Oh yeah.
And it was really fun too, seeing the whole like live comment section. I've done like interviews before, but this is the first time I've co-hosted. So thank you for the opportunity. And thank you to all the viewers out there and your comments and discussions. It's just been a very fun experience.
Yeah. I just wanted to add this comment from Bess. She said, same, I read murder mysteries. Bess is a cozy mystery writer. And then she reads murder mysteries in her off time. And she also cooks me dinner every week. I go to her house and we write, and she cooks dinner, or her husband does often. But she usually like kind of starts the conversation with like this interesting new poison she found out about this week. Like, you're cooking me dinner. Like, do I need to be concerned? All right. Ebony said, we did. It was great to meet you, Diana. Awesome. All right. So, Diana, I'm going to take you off the screen while I just finish up like the little tidbits at the end. And thank you so much. I'll see you
sometime. All right. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your holidays.
All right. So if you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe right down there so you don't miss another episode. Also, tell your friends if you enjoyed it. In the description, you can sign up for email subscriptions so you can get a reminder for each show. Also, the Patreon link is in the description. Thank you so much to all of my Patreon supporters. It really helps me, make the show without having to worry about like some of the technical costs and stuff like that. So it really means so much to me that y'all put in a couple of dollars every month. I really appreciate it. The social media for info for the guests is in the description. So you can find them on Twitter and Instagram and their websites as well. And also the social media info for Pub Talk Live. So you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. Join me in 2 weeks for the December 28th episode with Heidi Heilig and Danielle Clayton. And I'm super excited for those two. I can't wait for that conversation. It's going to be a great time. So make sure you tune in 2 weeks. Get away from your family or whatever you're doing for the
Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and to find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake and Jay Lynn.